the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Iran marked the second anniversary of the U.S. assassination of the legendary anti-terror commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. In a meeting with General Soleimani's family in Tehran, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said General Soleimani has turned into a role model and a hero for the younger generation. Meanwhile, tens of thousands have taken part in ceremonies to pay tribute to the highly charismatic commander.
Soleimani was commander who did not allow the terrorists to approach our borders. He defeated Daesh in Iraq and Syria, so the entire region always owes him a big thank.
American politicians thought that by killing General Soleimani, they would be able to let the terrorists win, but we are all going to preserve his legacy.
Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said the enemies were under the delusion that with the martyrdom of General Soleimani, quote, they would be done with their job. However, the U.S. fled Afghanistan as a result of the sacrifices made by Soleimani.
Afghan youth learned many lessons from him. Today, all the freedom-seeking people in the world regard him as a role model.
All Afghan people should follow his path, and he is in our hearts. We all look at him as someone who defeated arrogant powers.
Ayatollah Khamenei also said Washington is inevitably pulling out of Iraq and only has an advisory role there, without any military presence. Iran's leader warned Iraqi officials to be vigilant about the issue. On Saturday, Iraqis held rallies on the streets of the capital, Baghdad, to honor top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, both assassinated by the U.S. 2 years ago. Demonstrators called for the withdrawal of American forces from the country. Ayatollah Khamenei added the resistance front in Yemen is making gains, while the enemy has been brought to its knees in Syria. The leader, on Saturday, touched on the participation of tens of millions of people in Iraq, Iran, and other countries in the funeral and the processions held for General Soleimani after his assassination. General Soleimani is hailed as a hero of the fight against terrorism by people across the globe. The Islamic movement in Nigeria described General Soleimani as a hero of coordination between Christian and Muslim religions, leading victory over Daesh in Iraq and Syria. Also, Bolivia ex-president Evo Morales described General Soleimani as a hero in the fight against imperialism. The top Iranian anti-terror commander's assassination also exposed the U.S.'s support for terrorist groups and Washington's lies of countering terrorism. Iran has called on the United Nations to adopt a resolution condemning those behind the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. The Iranian president's office has made the call in a letter to the president of the UN General Assembly, saying the impunity granted to the perpetrators of the drone strike poses a threat to international peace and security. It stresses that attacks on government and diplomatic officials are crimes against humanity and violate the UN Charter and international law on human rights. It warns that inaction on state terrorism can lead to devastating consequences for the international community.
That type of extra-legal activity really was emphasized and came forward in a way that it had never seen before. Basically, to assassinate people in the middle of essentially a diplomatic mission in another country. And that's simply not possible to continue like that. And the response, of course, in Iraq was fury and the demand that the United States get out. So clearly, it's the wrong way to go from a whole variety of reasons, but especially a moral reason.
Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, was assassinated along with his companions, including Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, in a U.S. terrorist drone strike near the Baghdad International Airport on January 3, 2020. But the US was not alone in committing this heinous crime. Israel provided Washington with the key intelligence support, including tracking General Soleimani's cell phone. General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes were two iconic figures in the fight against the Daesh terrorist group that emerged amid the mayhem resulting from the US invasion of Iraq in 2003. Both commanders were admired by Muslim nations for eliminating the US-sponsored Daesh Takfiri terrorist group in the region, particularly in Iraq and Syria. Days after the brazen act, the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps launched a volley of missiles at two major military bases housing American forces in Iraq. Iran denounced the assassination as a state terrorism and vowed to end the American presence in the region as the ultimate act of revenge. The US assassination drew a wave of condemnation from officials and movements through the world and triggered huge public protests across the region.
The grief-stricken woman is the mother of the 14-year-old girl who died in her arms after being shot by an LAPD officer.
I have a 1 year come in from the inside, he's on the second floor.
On December 23rd, police are dispatched to a department store after receiving reports about a violent man beating up customers there with a heavy bike lock. One officer, wielding a rifle, fires shots at the assailant. But one of the bullets pierces through the dressing room's wall and hits the teenager, who's hiding there with her mother, in the chest. Valentina's body immediately goes limp. She is dead.
Right? I mean, shooting into a Burlington factory, basically a store, a clothing store, is insanity. Is insanity to do so with people while people are shopping there, and yet you have officers who are doing that because they aren't thinking rationally anymore. Rational thought has gone out of the minds of many of these individuals, and it has become solely almost like a cult, like a state-sanctioned army, if you will, who is locked in arms and feels like they are being attacked from every side. And so in order to defend themselves from these attacks, they are just getting more and more violent and aggressive.
She was the fifth person killed by the LAPD forces in a 9-day period. The sixth victim survived their injuries. None of them were armed with any firearms. The incident during Christmas time sparked outrage and criticism at one of the United States' largest police departments. The Los Angeles Police Department killed more than double the number of civilians in 2021 than it did in 2020. Activists believe the rise in the number of fatalities is because the officers rarely face consequences for their actions, if at all.
I cannot breathe. You're just a grown man. You're a tough guy.
The death of African-American George Floyd at the hands of a white Minneapolis officer in May 2020 sent shockwaves across the United States and prompted protests against police racism and brutality. Against that backdrop, however, the number of police killings remains high. In 2021, American police killed over 1,100 people. In the 2021 calendar, there were only 12 dates on which the police didn't kill anyone. 27% of the victims over the past year have been African American. This is while the minority group constitutes only 13% of the U.S. population.
Really, what the police are trying to show here through these killings, and it's not just through the killings, but through the marked increase in the number of killings from last year to this year, is that they are the ones with the power in these cities, that they are the ones with the right or the privileges to exercise their violence. They are the ones who can shoot first and then ask questions later. They're allowed to do that.
In the meantime, while more murder and manslaughter charges have been made against police officers, criminal charges and convictions have remained exceptionally rare. 98.3% of killings by police between 2013 and 2020 have not resulted in officers being charged with a crime.
So, on the one hand, even though you're seeing some of the officers get away with the violent acts that they're committing, and other ones get arrested and get sent to prison for their crimes that they committed, either way, the other officers who are watching all this happen, who are watching the attacks from the mainstream media, who are watching the attacks from the population, from the civilians, and who are watching that now their fellow brethren be locked up for crimes that, you know, they've either witnessed or committed themselves, this is causing a sort of defensive defensiveness on the part of police here in the United States, where they're uniting over their brotherhood in terms of being police officers before even uniting over, you know, their nationality, before even what it means to be an American, before what it even means to be a human being.
The families who've lost a member to police violence in the U.S. are demanding justice and accountability. Even if justice is served, they will have to live with the sobering thought that their loved ones won't ever come back.
China has harshly warned Chinese Taipei against making moves towards independence. Beijing says it will take drastic measures if the self-governed island crosses red lines. Chinese officials say provocation by separatist forces in Taiwan and, quote, external intervention could intensify in coming months. Foreign ministry officials say China is willing to try its utmost to seek peaceful reunification with Taipei, but would act if any red lines on independence were crossed.
Well, crossing the red lines for China would mean that Taiwan would declare independence. And it would be, in reality, would be against Taiwan's constitution. In order to change Taiwan's constitution, it would need us all to pass a referendum, which would need to have an approval of 75% of the legislative chamber. So at this stage, Taiwan's declaring independence, it's very unlikely.
Earlier in December, China's foreign minister stressed the need for Taipei to be reunited with Beijing, saying the self-ruled island is not a chess piece to be used by others. Wang Yi said the root cause of the new round of tensions lies with the island's authority that have attempted to solicit U.S. support for Taiwan independence. He also accused the United States and certain countries of deliberately using Taipei to contain Beijing. The top Chinese diplomat described Taipei's ambitions for independence as perverse actions and said the moves designed to change the status quo undermine peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait and violate the consensus of the international community as well as the basic norms governing international relations. China has sovereignty over Chinese Taipei, and under the One China policy, almost all the world countries recognize that sovereignty. The US, too, recognizes Chinese sovereignty over the island, but has long courted Taipei in defiance of Beijing.
If you look at the largest companies, Taiwanese companies, such as Foxconn and Pegatron, they have most of their workforce in the mainland. So it would be just an economical suicide for Taiwanese just to declare independence. And it's very unlikely. Independence is a planted idea by the US against China and Taiwan's interests.
The United States, which backs Taipei's secessionist president, continues to sell weapons to the island in violation of its own stated policy. After the Communist Party seized power in mainland China in 1949, the U.S. refused to recognize it as a rightful government in China. Instead, the U.S. had an embassy in Taipei. In the 1970s, Washington and Beijing decided to establish formal ties in a bid to create a counterbalance to the Soviet Union. And at the start of 1979, the US gave formal diplomatic recognition to the communist-run People's Republic of China and cut ties with Taipei. In doing so, Washington recognized the PRC as the sole legal government of China. It also acknowledged Beijing's position that there is only one China and that Taipei is part of it. After the US cut off formal relations with Taipei, Congress passed the Taiwan Relations Act. It has underpinned US ties towards the island ever since.
Well, the US policy regarding Taiwan is what they call a strategic ambiguity. It is officially respecting the One China policy, but in action, the US has clearly been undermining the One China policy by meddling into Taiwanese politics. The U.S. has groomed President Tsai Ing-wen since 2004.
In recent years, the U.S. has made China a top priority. The measure, known as the Pivot to Asia policy, was unveiled during Obama's administration and made East Asia, and China in particular, a top priority of the U.S. foreign policy. The Trump administration dramatically upped the ante against China. Back in October, U.S. President Joe Biden said the United States would come to Taipei's aid if it were to come under attack from China, claiming it had a commitment to defend the self-ruled island.
So besides that, the U.S. has been investing massively into Taiwanese politics and media through NED, the National Endowment for Democracy, which is the rebranded name for the CIA.
China blasted the statement, accusing Washington of meddling in Chinese internal affairs. The U.S. and China are also at loggerheads over a number of issues, including trade and the South China Sea.
The United States in 2021.
Chaos broke out very early in 2021 in the United States. Less than a week into the new year, the world was shocked by footage showing thousands of Americans besieging and storming the Capitol building in the heart of Washington, D.C. The reason? They wanted to stop the certification of Joe Biden's victory in the presidential election. Many called it an insurrection. Rarely has the world witnessed with such clarity the inherent division in the U.S. political system. What may previously have been a crack in the country's democracy now turned into a wide chasm. On January 13th, a week after the riots, Donald Trump became the first sitting U.S. president to be impeached twice. The House of Representatives began the trial of the controversial figure after he adamantly refused to concede election defeat and incited his fan to march on the Capitol and, quote, stop the steal. However, in yet another sign of the failure of the political duopoly, the Republican-held Senate did not find Trump guilty. Just like the first impeachment proceeding against him on charges of abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. On January 20th, Biden took office. The veteran Democrat, while on the campaign trail, had tried his best to demonize the incumbent leader and distance himself from his policies. By taking his place at the Oval Office, Biden towed Trump's line on multiple fronts. The Biden administration obediently followed its predecessor's maximum pressure campaign against Iran. Despite numerous pledges, it refused to stop supporting Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen. Biden even blatantly backtracked on his promise to change the U.S. approach towards migrants. People trying to cross into the U.S. faced even more hardship, and those who could get through suffered severe abuse. But that's not all. Getting COVID-19 under control was another pledge that Biden had made. But after almost a year in office, the U.S. remains on top in terms of both infections and death rates. In late December, COVID fatalities reached more than 800,000, but many Americans remained reluctant to get vaccinated as they do not trust their government. During the current administration, rampant gun violence was a major issue for many Americans. Moreover, little has been done to stop global warming, even though the U.S. rejoined the Paris Climate Accord, which Trump had quit. 2021 has not been a good year for civil rights either. Racial equality remains a distant dream for African Americans, despite a long jail term given to Derek Chauvin, a white officer who had violently killed a black man in the previous year. In September, bipartisan negotiations over a police reform bill collapsed. For now, it seems that minorities will still have to live in fear of police brutality.
Canada in 2021.
The United States' northern neighbor, Canada, also experienced a chaotic 2021. In May and June, authorities found nearly 1,200 bodies of Indigenous children buried in unmarked mass graves. The grim discovery refreshed the historical plight of the First Nation Canadians. The children of these communities were forcibly separated from their families during the 19th and 20th centuries and taken to infamous residential church schools where many of them suffered abuse and torture and many others went missing. The scandal rocked Canada's self-proclaimed image of human rights defender. A cultural genocide was what an investigative commission concluded, saying thousands had died and many were subjected to physical and sexual abuse at church-run schools in Canada. In 2021, Canada also saw continued protests calling for justice for thousands of missing or murdered Indigenous women. According to the Native Women's Association of Canada, Indigenous women are 3 times more likely to experience violence during the course of their life than their non-native counterparts. The damning figure is a clear sign of the deep-rooted colonialism worsened by state inaction. The country also experienced an unprecedented heat wave in the past year, which led to the death of hundreds of people. Wildfires burned for months throughout much of Canada, making it the 3rd worst wildfire season on record. Flooding was another natural disaster that prompted authorities in the Canadian Pacific Coast province of British Columbia to declare a state of emergency in November.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim,
Islamati,
Allah my Lord,
His word Quran,
Muhammad Prophet,
praise be upon,
I am Muslim for all of time.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Dear listeners, you're listening to IRIB English Radio and this is Youth Station. I'm your host Hassanain Inayatullah from India, a seminary student from Qom.
Assalamu alaikum, I am Jafar Saeed from Houston, Texas.
We all welcome you to the show and today we're going to discussing about elites. Actually, a few months ago, the Islamic Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei was addressing the elites as the light of nations' eyes. So what do you think about elites? Like, what are their specifications? Who do you call an elite?
Typically, when you hear the word elite, yeah, you think of the people who are, you know, well off, the top percent of, suppose, a country,
yeah,
or a nation, right? Where most of, say, the economy runs
well
through
off
them.
In what sense? In terms of knowledge, in terms of money, in terms of wealth?
Typically, the Supreme Leader was also referring to those elite in terms of knowledge.
Okay.
And not just, like, overall knowledge, but in specific fields.
But don't you think that elite means someone good at a particular task, you know, someone best at a particular task, at the field of study or the study of business? Don't you think like that?
That's what I'm saying, right? So it's not just knowledge in a whole.
Okay.
It's more specific towards a field, right? Mm-hmm. So say medical, but not just medical completely. Say, suppose, a neurosurgeon.
Okay.
Or, say, internal medicine,
yeah,
right? A very specific part of that business.
Yeah.
Right? Not just the business in its entirety.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at it from a Western point of view, an elite is someone who's, you know, living life, who's got all the money in the world, he's got a big place to live in, he's got multiple cars. But obviously, the Supreme Leader was talking to the people in a sense of knowledge and understanding one another. Not just, you know, the physical world and just having money and property.
Yeah, if we refer to the speech of the Supreme Leader, and then he says that, you know, first of all, he says that the elites are the nation's eyes. He also mentions that, you know, they have the various solutions for various types of problems. And he also said that by thanking all the people who he was addressing, he said that, you know, everyone should take their own responsibility. You know, even the talented and the people who are supposed to be their teachers. And elite should not just be in, it's not just about educational purposes, but you should also have gratitude with that. You should be, you know, gratitude to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Uh-huh.
You should be thankful.
You should be thankful for being, say, someone who has an expertise in a specific field. You understand that these elites, you can split them up into different groups here, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those who really put in the time,
okay,
right? They're really working on their craft,
yeah,
and they become experts in it.
Uh-huh.
Where they don't need to go and check with someone else. People come to them to make sure of, suppose, what they're doing is the right way of doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other group are people who, they just have a God-given talent, right? It just resonated with them.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't really have to put in a lot of work. They understood it immediately. They,
yeah,
grasped that concept, or I guess not just the concept, but how to carry out in, yeah, suppose, a specific field.
There's definitely a blessing from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But what sometimes we forget is, you know, we have that potential in ourselves, but we are depriving of turning the potential into actual.
I agree with that. And sometimes it's not even an outside force that's preventing us from doing it. We're our own barrier here. We're stopping ourselves from really actualizing that potentiality that's within us all.
Why do you think we stop ourselves? What are the factors that stop us?
Okay, what factors that really stop us? What other people think about us, right? What we think about ourselves. Like, some people, they judge themselves more than other people judge them, right? Uh-huh. So they're harder on themselves than the world is actually hard on them. So they see themselves at a higher stage mm-hmm. than what other people witness. So they put themselves under tremendous stress regarding the simplest things, right? That's one. You have the outside effect of people judging you for doing something, for saying something, for standing yeah. up for something. For most people, I guess this doesn't like specifically apply to the elite, mm-hmm. but it's you burn out in a specific field, right? Where you're like, no, I just don't want to do this anymore. I've been doing this, say, mm-hmm. 10, 15 years. You know, I'm tired now.
Like losing the passion, you mean to say?
Exactly, right? You're burning yourself from both ends.
Yeah.
Right? Like the drive that you had in the beginning, it's gone now. Whether that's that you're losing interest in that topic mm-hmm. or you're not getting the support that you were once getting. Mm-hmm. Say when you first started a specific, I guess, course yeah. or a specific ideology, there are people with you.
Yeah.
People are intrigued. They wanted to join you. But now you're slowly seeing those people leaving.
Yeah, let's just discuss that after a short break and we'll be right back.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Dear audience, welcome back to our show. And before the break, we're discussing about elites and their specifications. And we reached to a point that we see young students, they get into this field of studying or maybe any different field. But we see that after a span of time, they lose their interest in this field. And they're no more considered to be as an elite. Or they don't reach that stage of being called an elite. So what I think the factors that comprises of, you know, all these consequences, I feel like, you know, when a person is entering into a certain field, before entering into that field, he should know his interests, he should know his passions, he okay. should know about its consequences, what it can lead him to.
Okay, so with all this in mind, who would accompany this definition of an elite?
What field are you talking about?
No, I'm talking about in general. It doesn't have to be a specific field, but under this description of an elite that you just said right now, someone who's passionate about something that they're doing, who has a drive behind it.
Okay, like if you're talking about the religious personalities, like it's a different aspect. And if you're talking about, you know, I mean, if you're talking from Ahlul Bayt, it's a different aspect.
Okay.
If you're talking from scholars, it's again a different point of view. If you're talking from, like, you know,
the common people. Okay, so then why don't you just give an example of each one, right? Say, if you're separating them to that extent where the scholars are on one side,
okay.
the common people are on the other side, and then you have the Ahlul Bayt at a much higher level, then yeah. even with that like distinction, then I guess just give an example here. For I guess the Ahlul Bayt in its entirety
yeah.
are elite.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
So
exactly.
now...
You're right about that. The first person that comes in my mind when you talk about elite is Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Okay, so...
The perfect man. It's a deep ocean. You find everything over there. Mm-hmm. You find knowledge. You find piety. You find strength. You find everything over there. When you talk about elite in science, like in the modern sciences, you see, I see Einstein
okay.
as an elite.
Okay, so you told me one from, say, the scientific point of view.
Yeah.
But what about, again, we're going to go back to what you said earlier about the scholars.
Yeah.
What about someone who's, say, in the seminary?
Okay.
So the bigger scholars mm-hmm. who go and help other people out, what about them? Do you have an elite in mind out of them?
Actually, a couple of scholars. But, you know, it's, again, difficult to mention any one scholar, right? The first one that comes in my mind is maybe Ayatollah Khomeini.
Okay.
Because he was a great scholar, as you might know him. All the ijtihad we get from him, mm-hmm. you know, deriving Islamic laws and everything. You know, he had a great seminary in Najaf and all his students.
So in a way, he's changed the fabric of the seminary.
Exactly. You know, he has thousands of students who have passed from his madrasa, okay, or his college.
In your opinion, can someone who was brought up as a common man reach the stage of the elites?
Well, that's a good question. Sayyid Jafar, if you notice all the elites we're having now, before they were considered as to be an elite, they were all common people.
Okay.
So they reached, they passed the stage of being a common man to being an elite. Now, if you say that there might be people, they try very hard, like Allama Tabatabai, or Ayatollah Muhammad Hussein Tabatabai.
Okay.
As his name, the full name.
So he was a common man and he became an elite?
He was a common man. He used to go to the seminary to study Islam. He had to study one dars, one lesson, seven times.
So he put in the work to become an elite.
He put the work, and the point we mentioned before, you know, when you put the work, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala helps you.
Okay. You have a point here. If someone puts in the work, they can reach that status of eliteness. What if someone's putting in the work, but it's just not sticking in their head?
Exactly. That's the same example I'm giving you, right? Allama Tabatabai, he had to study one verse for seven times. He put in the work. Now, when you put in the work, what happens is, when you put in the work, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he pushes you to your goal.
Okay.
That's what happens. Then, he became the great Allama Muhammad Hussein Tabatabai.
I'm saying, suppose you grab someone from, say, Canada or America, right? Say someone who's an agnostic or an atheist. They don't believe in God, right? And you're like, look, you, I'm going to make you an elite, right? So this guy, he's not understanding basic, say, mathematical concepts, basic scientific theories, right? He doesn't have a belief in God. He doesn't have that, if I put in the work, God's going to, you know, do the other 50.
Yeah, I have a great example for you. I have a great answer for that question. Now, you find many elites in the Western countries. How many of you do think that they believe in God? You find many elites in the Western countries that they don't believe in God. How it works is, when you work really hard, Allah is the one who rewards you.
But realize this person doesn't have a belief in God, right? So he's just putting in the work. What you're saying is, you put in the work, and God's going to fill in the rest.
Yeah, you get what you work for.
But this person doesn't believe in God.
Yeah, you get what you work for.
Okay. So here, let me ask you one last question before we wrap up the show.
Okay.
When I asked you name an elite, you named Einstein.
Yeah.
Right? Obviously, the Western elites, they're well known across the world.
Yeah.
Right? But now, suppose I went and grabbed an American and asked them, you know, name, say, a Muslim elite. Mm-hmm. Someone who's changed the face of Islam to an extent.
Okay, like Ibn Sina, you might mention, yeah.
They won't have an answer. Mm-hmm. Why is it that their elites are more well-known, while the Muslim Islamic elites aren't known?
We are also a part of this fault that, you know, this thing did not spread well.
Okay.
You know, we did not propagate this thing.
So what could have we done to help propagate this better?
There might be two things, I guess. You know, either we did not propagate it well, or the other thing is, the others didn't let this thing to be propagated.
Okay. So you're saying, on one hand, it's our fault. On the other hand, is that they limited us propagating it in general.
When you talk about mathematics, you know, one of the main part of mathematics is algebra.
Okay.
The founder of algebra, or the father of algebra, is a Muslim, right?
Okay.
But how many of people know that?
Exactly. That's what I'm trying to say. How do we let them know, look, it was a Muslim elite, the master of math in general,
who came up with algebra? In fact, it's easier in these times, because you can use your social media platforms. Indeed, you can find many videos nowadays on YouTube where it mentions, like, you know, the Muslim founders of different things. Okay. You know, the first founder of university in different countries.
Okay.
Now, it's easier so that you can use these platforms and let the world know.
Okay. But then and they could also use these platforms to propagate their own elites more.
But we can still do our part, right?
That's fine. But I'm saying over here, you're saying that we have...
And one more responsibility what we have is we should encourage our Muslim youth to get forward in this field. We should encourage our children to reach that stage so that they become an elite. And the fathers and the teachers, they should help their children and the students. Today we discuss about elites and their specifications. It's actually really good when we encourage our students. We let them know about the Islamic scholars and the Islamic founders. We should encourage our children so that they reach that stage, so they can be identified or considered as an elite in the future, inshallah. That's all the time we have for today. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
The Limelight. In a letter to U.S. Senate Democrats, Majority Leader Chuck Schumer argued that the events of 6th of January 2021 are directly linked to a campaign by Republican state legislatures to impose voter restriction laws. We have prepared for you an article written by The Guardian journalist David Smith. The piece is titled, U.S. Democrats Bid to Change Senate Rules If Republicans Thwart Voting Rights Reform. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Democrats are seizing on this week's anniversary of the deadly U.S. Capitol riot to renew a push for voting rights legislation to safeguard their so-called democracy. Majority Leader Chuck Schumer announced on Monday, 3rd of January, that the Senate will vote on changing its own rules on or before 17th of January, the federal Martin Luther King Jr. Day holiday, if Republicans continue to obstruct election reform. The deadline appears part of a concerted effort to use Thursday, 6th of January's commemorations, marking a year since a mob of Trump supporters stormed the Capitol, seeking to overturn Joe Biden's election win to give fresh impetus to the long-stalled legislation. In a letter to Senate Democrats, Chuck Schumer argued that the events of 6th of January 2021 are directly linked to the campaign by Republican state legislatures to impose voter restriction laws. The New York Senator Chuck Schumer wrote, "Let me be clear, 6th of January was a symptom of a broader illness, an effort to delegitimize our election process, and the Senate must advance systemic democracy reforms to repair our republic, or else the events of that day will not be an aberration. They will be the new norm." He said, "Much like the violent insurrectionists who stormed the U.S. Capitol nearly 1 year ago, Republican officials in states across the country have seized on the former president's big lie about widespread voter fraud to enact anti-democratic legislation and seize control of typically nonpartisan election administration functions." sweeping voting rights reforms have stalled in the evenly split 50-50 Senate, repeatedly blocked by a Republican-led filibuster, leaving Democrats unable to find the 60 votes needed to advance. Chuck Schumer went further than before in calling for a filibuster exception for voting rights. Schumer said, "We must ask ourselves if the right to vote is the cornerstone of our democracy, then how can we, in good conscience, allow for a situation in which the Republican Party can debate and pass voter suppression laws at the state level with only a simple majority vote, but not allow the United States Senate to do the same? We must adapt. The Senate must evolve, like it has many times before." Chuck Schumer added, "We hope our Republican colleagues change course and work with us, but if they do not, the Senate will debate and consider changes to Senate rules on or before 17th of January, Martin Luther King Jr. Day, to protect the foundations of our democracy, free and fair elections." Although Chuck Schumer's words were ostensibly aimed at Republicans, there is little prospect of any members of the party shifting their position. On Monday, 3rd of January, Republicans swiftly condemned what they described as a threat. Senator Mike Lee of Utah said, "Senator Schumer's rash partisan power grab should be seen for what it is, desperation and a failure to do what Joe Biden and Democrats ran on, unify." Senator Mike Lee added, "If the rule change were to pass, the people of Utah and the United States would suffer immeasurably, as the Senate devolves into strictly majoritarian, Lord of the Flies environment. Senator Schumer and his disastrous plan must be stopped." But Chuck Schumer's true target, amid blanket media coverage of this week's anniversary, is likely to be Democratic holdout Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, who have resisted abolishing or changing the filibuster. The senators from West Virginia and Arizona contend that if and when Republicans take control of the chamber, they could use the lower voting threshold to advance bills Democrats oppose. Chuck Schumer's announcement is likely to set up 6th of January vigils and Martin Luther King Jr. Day events as rallying points for voting rights activists who have criticized Joe Biden and the party in Congress for failing to prioritize the issue. But the president has become less cautious and more direct. Last month, he told ABC News, "If the only thing standing between getting voting rights legislation passed and not getting passed is the filibuster, I support making the exception of voting rights for the filibuster." As Chuck Schumer claimed, his announcement was welcomed by Martin Luther King III, son of the civil rights activist and chairman of the Drum Major Institute. He said, "There is no better way to honor my father's legacy than protecting the right to vote for all Americans." The King holiday is historically a day of service, and we hope the United States Senate will serve our democracy by passing the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. He said, "We applaud Senator Schumer for his commitment to expanding voting rights, but we won't halt our plans for action until legislation has been signed." Also on Monday, 3rd of January, the U.S. Conference of Mayors sent a letter, signed by 146 bipartisan mayors, to Senator Chuck Schumer and the majority leader, Mitch McConnell, urging them to act this month. It noted that in the past few months alone, 19 states passed 34 laws and made it harder to vote. The mayors wrote, "American democracy is stronger when all eligible voters participate in elections, yet voting rights are under historic attack and our very democracy is threatened. These bills would stop this voter suppression. They would create national standards for voting access in federal elections that would neutralize many of the restrictive voting laws passed in the states."
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of a speech delivered on December 12, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in meeting with a number of nurses and the families of those martyred while working in the health profession.
Now, let me discuss the issue related to nurses. What I wish to say is primarily a discussion of the value of nurses. This is one point that I will discuss. Afterwards, I will look at the hardships and difficulties endured by nurses. We should know what these hardships are. The Iranian nation should know what nurses are enduring during their jobs. Another point is about nurses' demands. Well, officials are thankfully present in the meeting. I will speak about some, but not all of the demands that nurses have. As for the value of nurses, there is an important point, and that is helping people in need of help. In other words, a nurse is a person who helps another person who needs help for everything. That person needs water, food, comfort for sleep at night, medication, and other needs. Like an angel of salvation, nurses help these people who are in dire need of help.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Well, helping a person in need is a lofty value in all cultures, and even more so in the case of people with the most needs, that is to say, patients. This is an important point, which is about helping those who are in need. I should add that one recommendation and one command issued by mystics and spiritual monotheistic people is about helping those in need. In other words, you nurses are actually obeying an important monotheistic command when you are doing your job. Such is the importance of this job. This is a very lofty value. This is one point. Another value of nurses lies in the fact that it is a difficult task. There are more rewards for difficult tasks, and such tasks are of more value. A task that is accomplished with difficulty and for which a person endures hardship is of more value in God's balance. This is because such tasks are accomplished by hardship. Later on, I will briefly discuss these hardships. Therefore, nurses is of more value. It is more important than other kinds of assistance because it is a difficult job.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. through all my years I've been lost. You've guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
In the limelight.
French President Emmanuel Macron has declared the year 2022 must be a turning point for Europe as France took over the rotating presidency of the European Union. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at Agence France-Presse. The piece is titled Turning Point for Europe, Macron Takes EU Helm as French Election Looms. French President Emmanuel Macron has declared the year 2022 must be a turning point for Europe as France took over the rotating presidency of the European Union. In a New Year's Eve national address, the French President hailed the European Union's role during the COVID-19 crisis and announced an ambitious agenda for the bloc that could also serve his domestic campaign for re-election. Emmanuel Macron vowed that "You can count on my complete commitment to ensure that this period, which comes around every 13 years for France, is a time of progress for you." The centrist, who made his Europhile views a key part of his election campaigning when winning the presidency in 2017, is hoping it will again serve him in elections scheduled this April. The European Union presidency gives him a welcome platform to put his European record to the forefront and differentiate himself from his rivals and bring new proposals, new ideas to the table, said Claire Demesme from the Centre Marc Bloch think tank in Berlin, Germany. Prominence on the international stage has also long been a popular move for any French president. The French like nothing more than the image or impression of France being at the control, said Pierre Salal, a former diplomat at the French mission to the European Union. Sébastien Mélard, director of the Jacques Delors Institute, a pro-European Union think tank based in Paris, said Emmanuel Macron will also face pressure to deliver after having ramped up expectations. Sébastien Mélard said, "He can't get to the first round of the presidential election on 10th of April without having obtained some results from the European presidency." Sébastien Mélard added, "That's the challenge for Macron, but it can also be a real opportunity." European leaders are set to meet in Paris on 10th and 11th of March, which could be a chance for them to agree on a major reform of the bloc's budget rules. Much will depend on Germany's new Chancellor, Olaf Scholz, whose coalition government is seen as sceptical on budget reforms, but supportive of Emmanuel Macron's agenda. "France's presidency is an important opportunity we want to seize together to strengthen Europe and make it fit to rise up to tomorrow's challenges," the German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock said. Meanwhile, Pierre Salal, the former French diplomat, said France's partners would take a dim view of attempts to instrumentalize the presidency for electoral reasons. Domestically, opponents have already accused Emmanuel Macron of electioneering and say he should have delayed France's turn at the helm of the European Union until after the elections in France. It's a mistake. He's doing it for his own interests, not those of France. His right-wing rival, Valérie Pécresse, from Les Républicains party, said last month. Eurosceptic opponents such as far-right figures Marine Le Pen and Eric Zemmour will also waste no opportunity to portray the whole exercise as meaningless. It's been 4.5 years that he's been in power, and he's obtained nothing and done nothing in the European domain apart from achieving a sort of submission to Germany in the name of Franco-German couple, Marine Le Pen told RMC Radio in mid-December.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
After almost 140 days of his hunger strike, the 40-year-old Palestinian prisoner Hisham Abu Hawash is in imminent danger, facing the risk of sudden death at any moment. Representatives of Palestinian factions and prisoners' advocacy groups in the occupied Ramallah took to the streets again, sounding the alarm over the health condition of Abu Hawash, who is protesting his illegal administrative detention without charge or trial.
My brother Hisham could die at any moment. This is according to medical reports by the doctors who have directly examined Hisham. We are really worried about his health. Israel is using a new form of assassination against our brothers.
The International Committee of the Red Cross has meanwhile issued a statement demanding Israel to immediately release Abu Hawash. Israel claims it keeps some Palestinians behind bars without disclosing sensitive information that could expose valuable sources. In the case of Abu Hawash, Israeli intelligence claims he's an activist of the jihad movement. However, it was not able to provide explicit evidence in support of its allegations. Palestinian human rights organizations say it's yet another attempt to bring Palestinian prisoners to their knees and prevent them from being engaged in any form of struggle.
My brother Hisham could die at any moment. This is according to medical reports by the doctors who have directly examined him. We are really worried about his health. Israel is using a new form of assassination against our brothers.
Last month, the Israeli regime accepted to release hunger-striking prisoner Kaid al-Fasfus after 131 days of his protest, where his release was seen as yet another form of victory. As Israel reportedly holds over 4,500 Palestinian prisoners, hundreds of them are languishing behind bars without charge or trial under the illegal so-called administrative detention. Palestinians pray that Abu Hawash's life could be saved before it's too late. Abu Hawash, who's literally on the verge of death, has said before his health severely deteriorated that he will continue his hunger strike until victory. That is, according to him, his release or his martyrdom. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Inside the former U.S. Embassy in Tehran, Iranian judicial experts gathered to reveal the details of a probe into the U.S. assassination of Iranian top military commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. General Soleimani was the commander of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, which is in charge of conducting overseas operations. He was assassinated in January 2020 in a U.S. drone strike outside Baghdad International Airport on a direct order from then U.S. President Donald Trump.
سفسطه آمریکایی ها در توجیه اقداماتش